2003, and colleagues, the order that we're going to be looking at the agenda today, we'll first have a work session on House Bill 3442, then we will skip down and have a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 908. After that will be Senate Bill 919, and then Senate Bill 909. And then we'll go back up to the top. The fifth that we look to is House Bill 3638. And then finish it up with Senate Bill 757. So with that, open up a work session on House Bill 3442. And we have... let's see, for the committee, the A3 amendments that should be in your folders presented to you. And Gary Conkling, can you come forward, please? And while Mr. Conkling is coming forward, I'm looking for him to explain First, colleagues, House Bill 3442 has already passed out of rules. It was referred to Ways and Means. It's now back to us. The A3 amendments is what was an issue that came up while it was in the Ways and Means process that we'll have Mr. Conkling explain. And then for your information, too, you do have in your packets today the fiscal analysis with information there as well. So, Mr. Conkling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers. Thank you for scheduling House Bill 3442 today for a work session. This bill will look familiar to you and that you passed it on before. You'll recall that in your approval of this measure, before it went to Ways and Means, it went there with the agreement of the governor who was still considering one element of the bill, which is who would be the agent to approve the strategic plan that would be developed by the Oregon Wine Board. The bill, as you passed it, called for the governor to have that responsibility, which he at his discretion could delegate. Subsequent to that, the governor's office indicated that the governor preferred to have a specific state agency with that responsibility, in collaboration with the governor's office and the Department of Economic and Community Development, we selected that agency, and the A3 amendment effectively accomplishes that. This was an amendment that was pending upon the bill leaving here. It was, in fact, added in the Ways and Means Subcommittee when this bill was considered, and would recommend you including it here today. The bill, if I might just add, went to Ways and Means to accomplish a couple of relatively administrative functions, one of which is to take positions out of the Department of Agriculture and also to change the account name for the continuing appropriation. Both of those, at least to my understanding, have been effective in other legislation through Ways and Means.
Okay. Any questions, Mr. Conkling? All right. Ms. Forrest?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash A3 amendments.
Representative Forrest has moved adoption of the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3442. Any discussion? Any objections? All right. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of House Bill 3442 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Forrest has moved House Bill 3442 as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Close?
Both aye.
Representative Forrest?
Aye.
Representative Blunt Sanderson?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Chair Doyle?
Chair votes aye. And I think the chair will carry this instead of putting it on the consent calendar. What do you think? Does it need to be on the consent calendar? Or is it an issue? Well, it's passed out of committee, but not on the floor.
Oh.
Kind of a substantive issue.
Are you looking for a carrier?
Well, I'm just thinking, do we just put it on consent?
Sure.
I'd say consent.
Sure.
Okay. Go on consent calendar.
We'll have plenty of things to argue about.
This is one of the easier ones.
I'm
fine putting it on the consent calendar. So ordered, and that then also closes the work session on House Bill 3442. All right, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 908. And let's see, Pat Schwach, can you come forward?
Can we have David Nebel up here with us too?
Sure, please? David Nebel.
I think John wants to join us. Chairman Doyle and the group. My name is Pat Schwach, and Executive Director for Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. I'm here today on behalf of John Van Landingham, who is in Virginia on a vacation. So I'll do the best I can and let David Nebel help me. This is a testimony that John has prepared for us, and it was the same testimony that we used when it went through the Senate. As with House Bill 2765, what the legislature already approved this session, Senate Bill 908 is the product of a coalition of residential landlord and tenant groups and advocates, except that this time the subject is limited to manufactured dwelling tenancies and manufactured home parks, known as facilities, and including floating homes and marinas. Members of the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition are Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon, Oregon State Tenants Association, Pat Schwach and Susan Delatour, Lane County Law and Advocacy Center, John Van Landingham, Oregon Park Owners Alliance, Paul Brewer, Paul Cook, and Charlie Grief, Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, Troy Brost, Alan Conley, Chuck Carpenter, Phil Quarren, and John Brenneman, Oregon Rental Housing Association, Sharon Fleming Barrett, Norton Cable, and Sean Miller, Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, Emily Cedarleaf, and Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, Don Miner. The coalition's meetings were facilitated by E. Ford of Community Services Department, whose Ginny Arana was also a member of the coalition. Senate Bill 908 is identical to House Bill 3069, except for one word LC changed, earlier to earliest, on page 2, line 45. This is not a substantive change. House Bill 3069 passed the House on May the 12th by unanimous vote. Unfortunately, House Bill 3069 was still in the Senate Business and Labor Committee when it closed last month. Senate Bill 908 is an effort to revive House Bill 3069 and complete the coalition's work for this session. And John's comment is that while this bill appears intimidating with 14 sections and 32 pages, it actually addresses only 5 issues. The length is a result of amending 2 nearly identical statutes that are quite long and correcting cross-references in several other statutes. I don't know if you want us to address all of those.
I don't think we
whatever you'd like.
Since this has already passed the House once, I'm kind of deferring to the decision our members have already made on this issue.
Yes, so. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Nebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm here to support this bill and to support the work of the coalition and my colleague John Van Landingham, who drafted this bill and this testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee has about the substantive provisions of the bill, or I can go through them if you'd like me to, but the chair has just indicated that that might not be necessary. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we support this bill.
Okay. Mr. Brenneman?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I
I'm a lobbyist for Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. I'm sitting in for Chuck Carpenter, who I think is running just a little late. He was going to come and offer support as one of the participants. This is our third or fourth session, Pat agrees, that this group has managed to sit down and craft a bill that makes it through the process. And it is trying at times, but I think we've done a pretty good job in being persistent and putting something together. And it does help legislators when you go back in the interim and can point to some of the positive things that are done by the landlords and the tenants in concert.
Yep.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I have no question, but I do need to state that I do own a manufactured home in Zell.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I may have been rule gathering when you talked about the what happened with an identical bill earlier. I take it you so told us that it went through a different committee in the House and that we all that it passed the House. Would you mind reminding me of that?
Certainly, Chair Doyle and Representative Barnhart. Sitting next to you is the young lady who carried this bill originally, which was 3069. She did a good job, and it went through the House, and everything was just fine. And then it got mired across the way. And so it then was put into a priority bill, renumbered, and it's back to you again. So hopefully this is the end of this mess.
Just to follow up, so this is Senator Walker's priority bill.
Yes, it was Senator Walker's priority bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, call the vote count on the House floor on that one.
Was unanimous.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, it was 58 ayes, 2 excused.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
And let's see. No one further here to testify on 908. Seeing none, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 908. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 908.
Mr. Chair, before I move adoption, I just would like to comment that this particular piece is very important to a number of constituents in my district because I do have a number of mobile home parks, and the issues that this coalition is working to address is very important.
So you're about to move the...
I am about to do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of...
No.
Due pass. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Senate Bill 908 with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Backlund.
I'm going to vote for this bill, but I just wanted to comment that... it's impressive to read and hear and discuss, actually, with folks who have formed a coalition of a number of different stakeholders, and they come to consensus. I think that's pretty impressive. And I think we have a good bill here again.
Okay. Further discussion? All right. Call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Mona
Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
Chair votes aye. And is there another consent calendar item since we've already discussed this on the floor once? All right. Put it on consent calendar. And Senate Bill 908 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close public work session on Senate Bill 908. And now we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 919. And we welcome Ray Kelly as the administrator of this bill. Ray, can you give us just a summary of this bill and why I think this is another one that's come back?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 919 was House Bill 2965, passed the House floor 57-1. Previously as House Bill 2965. What the measure does is revise the prohibition against unlawful use of titles suggesting a person is licensed landscape contractor, and it limits provisions of casual, minor, and inconsequential landscaping work by landscape maintenance businesses, Mr. Chair.
Okay. There are representatives of the landscape contractors here, but I'll kind of defer to the committee if there's questions to be asked on this bill. If not, we can just take it into work session.
I have one question.
Do you have a question? Okay, Bill Cross and Mike Snyder.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and with me is Mike Snyder, the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board, and we would be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a copy of the bill? Page 2, when it starts talking about the $500, it's listing exemptions that this would not apply. Could you explain what B on line 15, 16 means regarding the $500?
Chair Doyle, Representative Anderson, I'm Mike Snyder with the Landscape Contractors Board. This was in our original, it's always been in the statute, the $500 exemption. What this is, the intent of this law is a person is doing landscape maintenance and a shrub dies or a tree dies or some lawn dies out that needs to be repaired. The landscape maintenance person can replant that shrub, replant that tree, reseed that lawn up to a $500 limit per site per year. That's what that does. So they don't have to call a landscape contractor in to do that replacement planning.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Representative Close.
And can you tell me, on page 3, you've made reference to the Portland, Salem, Oregon, Washington Consumer Price Index? What is that exactly?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close. What that is we have in our statute, several years ago, we had a case where a developer developed his own property, and we took him to court and lost. Our statutes didn't stand up to that, and so we are put in our statute a $2,500 limit on developers to develop their own property before they have to hire a landscape contractor to do that work. That was subject to a 5-year review. Every 5 years, we have to go back to the Portland, Washington Consumer Price Index and update that amount. So, as of September, that has now risen to a $3,000 limitation because the Consumer Price Index has increased the amount that they can do. Does that make sense? You understand that?
Yes, I guess I was wondering why you're adding Salem. You're taking out Portland.
I don't know where that came in. I don't know where that came from, actually.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, could that be a new name used by the by the Bureau of Labor and Statistics for that for the Portland CPI? I'm making that up. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that was inserted by legislative council, so I am assuming that your assumption may be correct in terms of referencing the consumer market. But that was inserted by legislative council, not at our request. I'm just assuming they are doing it when any reference to the price index is contained in statutes now.
Thank you.
Yeah, in committee, that's my understanding as well, is that it's just a style issue for legislative council. So it's not identifying a new source beyond what they've used in the past for determining increases in consumer price index. Further questions? All right. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
And seeing no one further to testify on Senate Bill 919, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 919, open up a work session on Senate Bill 919. And Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 919 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 919 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Montesander?
Aye.
Representative Mitchell?
Aye.
Trigilio?
Chair votes aye, and see another candidate for the consent calendar. No objection, so ordered. And Senate Bill 911 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on Senate Bill 911. 919. Looking, and Ray, oh, sorry, never mind. And we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 909. And ask Scott Berry and Lana Butterfield to come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. Senate Bill 909 is the reincarnation of House Bill 23, which passed out of the House with a 58-0 vote. There were two excused. I think Representative Moyes Anderson was one of those, so this may be slightly new for you. But it went over to the Senate and actually came out of the Senate committee. There was a concern about one piece of the bill with legislative counsel and how the one amendment was written. It was therefore sent back to Senate Business Committee to have that amendment redrafted. That was done, but unfortunately the committee closed. And so we've reincarnated the bill into Senate Bill 909. It's, again, the same bill as 2389 and has not had a no vote yet.
And just for the record, I think most committee members are... Maybe not everyone here believes in reincarnation, but we all support recycling. So, another recycled bill here. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
I take it that the defect that the Senate Business Committee found and repaired has also been repaired in this version of the bill.
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. Yes.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment for the record that 2389 had quite a bit of work in the House Business Labor and Consumer Affairs Committee, and Scott Berry did a lot of work in working with all the parties involved and came up with a very good bill, so I congratulate him for sticking with it.
Ms. Butterfield, do you have anything to add?
Simply that, for the record, my name is Lana Butterfield, representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho, and we've worked with the Oregon Building Industry Association. We believe that this bill will be very helpful in the concerns that they're having with insurance in their particular field. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. And no one further to testify on this bill. And therefore, we can close public hearing on Senate Bill 909, open up a work session. Senate Bill 909, Representative Flores.
I move Senate Bill 909 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 909 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Right, call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Montesander?
Aye.
Representative
Richard?
Aye.
Chair Doyle?
Chair votes aye. And another consent calendar?
Aye.
Without objection, so ordered. And that also moves Senate Bill 909 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 909. And open up a work session on House Bill 3638. And ask Bob Cantine to come forward. Colleagues, you may recall, we've visited 3638 a few weeks ago, almost 4 weeks ago now, and asked the counties to take this issue back to the governor's office and see if they can work out some issues that were the governor's office had with this particular bill. And I think Mr. Cantine has some good news to report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. And you say it's been a little over a month since we were here, and we were given that opportunity to go back with a number of state agencies and see if we could find some common ground and come back to you with a consensus bill that we could all support. And we have done that, and I believe you have a letter, and I've attached it to my material that I've submitted to you from the governor's office, Aaron Kelly Seal, indicating their agreement with the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3638, and I think almost as important, committing themselves to interim work on a variety of issues about how the state and the counties work together. So that was a very important set of meetings that we had and very productive. I want to thank and express my appreciation to Aaron Kelly Seal, to Gary Weeks, to a number of the department heads that had a number of meetings with us, and we ended up working out the Dash 4 amendments that you have before you. I would be glad to answer any questions you might have. Basically, that Dash 4 amendment narrows all of our conversation down to one area, and that is the Section 1 of, I believe it's 436-630, the mental health piece, where we all agreed in our conversation we're probably the most vulnerable to reductions in funding coming out of this session, and therefore were the area most urgently in need of this legislation. The other issues we will take up and talk about in the interim. So I would like to say to you, I hope you can find it possible to recommend approval of this bill, and I would also, with the Dash 4 amendments, and also ask that you consider removing the referral to Ways and Means, since the bill as it stands now, those provisions that would have caused that referral or reason for it have been taken out of the bill. And I believe there's a report of no fiscal impact, as I understand. And I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
To clarify that indeed Legislative Fiscal has come out with a statement saying there is no fiscal impact on the Dash 4 amendments if the committee chooses to adopt those. Any questions, Mr. Cantine? Representative Monica Anderson.
Thank you. Just so that I understand, because of the financial crisis that we do have, and a lot of counties are going to say that they cannot provide certain services, mental health services, what if then a county then says we can't provide certain mental health services and a person sues? What happens in that circumstance? Would they then be suing the county, or does the state take on that liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, they certainly can sue the county, and they might sue both the county and the state at the same time. At least in this case, we would then both go in with the same defense. And so we would have the parallel posture in the court. But yes, they can sue both of us.
Thank you.
Was that close?
I had my question answered. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Berger.
Yes. Does this, one of the issues that you're perhaps going to talk about in the interim, would be the Commission on Children and Families. Are they out of this particular Dash 4 amendment? I didn't see them anywhere, but I just wanted to be sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, they are out of this and will be part of a much bigger interim discussion.
Right. Okay.
Further questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. And colleagues, also we want to enter into the record the July 29, 2003 letter from Barry S. Cass, Assistant Director of Health Services, which is in your at the in your file. And let's see, no one, well, as work session, I guess we can move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3638.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of the Dash 4 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so ordered. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3638 to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation, and that's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
First, the floor says move House Bill 3638 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Votes aye.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Monsanto.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
And chair votes aye. And consent calendar, once again, any objection? Seeing none, we'll move it to the consent calendar. And House Bill 3638, we'll move to the floor of the due pass as a amended recommendation. And that closes the work session on House Bill 3638. And that leaves us with Senate Bill, public hearing on Senate Bill 757. And about John Schultz, have you come forward and help explain this bill to us? Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Schultz, and I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And thank you for the opportunity to appear today to request the committee's support of Senate Bill 757A. And we believe that this bill will improve the equity of permanent partial disability awards for injured workers in their workers' compensation claims. And as importantly, we think this bill will simplify a complex benefit structure. I want to talk a little bit about, give you a little bit of background about the existing law, and I think that'll help put what we're recommending into context. But I don't intend to go on very long. Oregon's workers' compensation system, like most state workers' compensation system, has four major types of indemnity or cash benefits, and that's non-medical treatment benefits. And one of those benefits here in Oregon is permanent partial disability. And that's intended to compensate workers when they have a permanent disability, and it compensates them for their permanent impairment and their permanent loss of earning capacity that's caused by the injury. Now, Oregon, like most other states, has, or a number of other states anyways, has two basic types of permanent partial disability benefits. Scheduled benefits, and those are for things that relate to specific body extremities like your arms, your hands, toes, your hearing, your sight. If you lose the your sight or you're impaired in your right upper extremity, there's actually a schedule that you can go to that talks about the amount of permanent partial disability that will be awarded for that impairment. And then there's unscheduled benefits. Unscheduled benefits relate to other body parts, the back, the trunk primarily, mental functions. And unscheduled benefits are a little bit more complex. Now, once a disability has been rated by a physician, the physician tells the insurance company how much impairment and disability there really is present, then there's a rather complex benefit formula that translates that rated percentage of disability into an actual dollar amount that's paid to the worker. In Oregon, the result is somewhat unlike other states, however, because of some of the things that we do currently with our law. We have a fixed benefit amount that does not adjust annually with the state average weekly wage unless we come here to the legislature and ask for adjustments. The benefit doesn't reflect the worker's wage in any way. The benefit pays scheduled awards at a higher single fixed rate than it pays unscheduled awards. And unscheduled awards are paid actually at three different rates, or what we call tiers, with higher dollar awards going for more serious conditions. About 70% of the unscheduled awards, however, are paid at the lowest tier entirely. So you're probably imagining at this point it is a rather complex benefit structure to try to figure out. And try to explain this to injured workers does take some creativity and ingenuity and time usually to be able to explain this benefit structure. It is complex. And relative to other states, in addition to that, Oregon benefits are relatively high for workers with the so-called scheduled injuries, but they're low, as compared to other states, for workers with unscheduled injuries. And then this distortion is magnified when you start bringing wages into consideration, as many other states do. Many other states base their permanent partial disability benefits at least partially on the workers' wages. And what happens then is that Oregon becomes one of the most generous states for low-wage workers with scheduled injuries, but it's one of the least generous states for high-wage workers with unscheduled disabilities. So these issues began to emerge over the last couple of years, and they began to concern many of us about our benefit structure for permanent partial disability. And to summarize what was the problem, we had a complex benefit system with tiered and unscheduled structures. The equity of our awards seemed out of balance. And Oregon did not compare very well when we looked at ourselves versus other states. We were either too high in some awards or too low in other awards. So management and labor worked together during the interim between since the last session to evaluate the adequacy and the equity of our benefits, both internally to Oregon and then with respect to other states. And they agreed on several goals for trying to develop a better permanent partial disability system. Those goals were to retain predictability and objective factors, to explore wage-based benefits for the first time in Oregon in order to better match compensation to lost earnings, to simplify the benefit structure, to achieve and maintain or exceed parity with the benefit amounts of other states, and to encourage return to work for an injured worker. And I'm happy to report that Senate Bill 757 achieves all of those goals. Now, to talk about the bill specifically, this proposed bill is structured to be roughly cost neutral with the total amount of permanent partial disability benefits that are paid out in the workers' compensation system currently. While it maintains that cost neutral position to what we're paying currently, it does make a number of positive changes to the workers' compensation statute. It simplifies the process by eliminating this distinction between scheduled and unscheduled. There will be no more distinction between unscheduled and scheduled body parts if this bill passes in the benefit formula. And it eliminates entirely the unscheduled three-tier system. It distinguishes between workers who return to or refuse an appropriate offer of regular work and those who don't. It uses the state average weekly wage to define minimum and maximum benefits. It provides all workers with permanent partial disability who have an impairment, and that benefit is now going to be paid at the same rate. It is not paid at the same rate under the current system. And it would be based on the state average weekly wage, and it will be based on a percentage of impairment. It provides workers who are unable to return to their regular work with a work disability benefit in addition to the impairment benefit. That would be based on impairment modified by age, education, and adaptability factors, which our current system does. It's the same as our current system. What would change, however, is that the worker's earnings at the time of injury would make up the benefit basis. And the bill provides that wage-based work disability benefits would be limited to a range between 50% and 133% of the state average weekly wage, which, while that would be adjusted annually, it provides a floor and a ceiling. And that helps retain the predictability of the benefit structure. Finally, I want to mention that this bill adds a sunset clause. If the amendments aren't readopted 4 years after the effective date of the bill, the law would revert back to our present system. In summary, this bill, if it's passed, is going to shift how the money is distributed amongst injured workers who have permanent partial disability. Higher awards are now going to be paid to workers who can't return to their regular jobs, and also who probably had higher incomes at the time of their injury. What this does is it improves the equity of benefit amounts across the system by better matching benefits to actual earnings lost for the first time here in Oregon. So we respectfully request the committee's support of Senate Bill 757A and that you do send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'd be glad to answer questions if I can. I know I went through that very rapidly.
Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the current state average weekly wage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, if you allow me a second, I think I can find that for you. I know approximately, but I don't want to give you the wrong number, and I think I have it in here. The current state average weekly wage is approximately, it's just above $650 per week.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe two questions. John, I'm looking at some of the problems that we now have. And your handout indicated that, quote, this distortion is magnified when wages are considered, making Oregon among the most generous states for low-wage workers with scheduled disabilities, but among the least generous states for high-wage workers. Can you recall, just for my interest, how we came to that state, how that ever developed? That's kind of a history question, I know. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, I don't know the answer to that. In fact, we've been asking that question over the last couple of years. And this law, while some of the factors have been changed over the last 20 years, goes back a long time. There isn't anybody that we could find who knows exactly why the system was set up the way it was. When it was set up, it goes back many, many years. So I'm not sure I can answer why it was set up that way.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. One other thing on what the bill does, you mentioned that we have a range between 50% and 133% of the state average. Do you have any idea what that would typically mean? Would that be typically 75%, or is that possible to say, prognosticate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, typically injured workers fall a little bit on the average below the state average weekly wage. Exactly where in there, I'm not sure. We can get that information probably for you, but typically the bell curve of injured worker wages is a little bit less than the average worker's wages here in Oregon. But we also do have injured workers who make very high wages at times. Some of the workers, especially in the building trades and such, who can have rather catastrophic injuries too. Mm-hmm. But another factor there is that oftentimes new workers, typically workers who have worked for 6 months or less for an employer, up to 37%, I think is the last number I saw, of workers who are injured in a year are workers who've worked for an employer 6 months or less. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of factors that go into why workers are typically a little lower paid. The injured workers are a little lower paid. A lot of younger workers also get injured. The extent of their injuries typically are a little less. Workers at my age group, we get injured less. However, we typically stay injured a little bit longer. We don't heal up quite as fast.
You're not telling us what your age group is, are you?
It almost goes back to the beginning of this stuff.
Good answer. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Schiltz, one of the basic premises here is that scheduled or unscheduled benefits are based on the doctor's report. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, yes, it's at least partially correct. The doctor essentially gives the diagnosis of the conditions that the worker is suffering as a result of their industrial injury, and depending on what the doctor will tell us, if there's permanent impairment at the time that the worker's condition is finally stabilized, is going to determine whether or not there's going to be a permanent partial disability award. And so if in some cases it can be mixed, both unscheduled and scheduled injuries. For example, a worker with a low back injury could also have leg involvement because of that low back injury, and in that case you'd have both scheduled and unscheduled body parts involved. Is that getting to your question?
It does. One of the most common complaints that I get as a legislator is through the workman's compensation that people are sent from one physician to another physician to another physician, sometimes located several hours away from their home base. And while it's not exactly in the bill, it's a nexus because it precedes what this bill does. And so I wonder if you might comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, just two things come to mind. There are some limitations in the existing law about how many times an insurance company can refer a worker to for what's known as an independent or an insurer medical examination. They're only allowed to do that three times each time the claim is open, but that three times can be a lot for certain workers, especially if they live out in a rural area. On the other hand, the insurer's trying to get an objective view of what's going on with the claim. They may have concerns about the treatment the worker's getting. They may have concerns about whether or not the worker is medically stationary or not. So they also have an interest, and there's competing interests at play here. Secondly, the Management Labor Advisory Committee has decided to look at the independent medical examinations during this next interim and make that an area of review where the department will help the Management Labor Advisory Committee to produce some data about this exact issue. There was a bill that was brought forward that didn't go very far this session, but it did bring the Management Labor Advisory Committee's attention to this issue, and so they have committed to taking a look at that.
Okay, follow up.
Sure, follow up.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm from District 9, which is a coastal area,
mm-hmm.
And so people are sent to Eugene or Portland or Salem, so they're usually sent over to the valley, and that's been a common complaint. The second complaint is, which is connected to that same problem which precedes this bill, and that is that when they call to try to straighten out, either I don't have a ride to go to Eugene, or it's impossible for me to do that, why don't you take my first doctor, that they are not treated cordially or respectfully. And so I want to share that with you in hopes that if there is some added training that's needed by those employees who are handling these, because I have to tell you, it is a common thread of complaint to my office.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I appreciate the input, and we are interested in getting feedback from workers about their subjective experience with these examinations. That's part of what we're interested in finding out about.
Mm-hmm. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schultz, your testimony indicates, and you stated that the workers' comp determination system is pretty complex, and this is an attempt to simplify that. And I'm just curious, because starting on page 5 and moving to page 6, when you're talking about, and it's likely because I just don't have the knowledge that is required here, but talking about number of degrees against the disability is more than 64 but equal to or less than 160, then 153 times 64 plus $267.44 times the number of degrees in excess of 64, and it goes forward. It seems, is that simple?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, absolutely not. No, it's a very complex system, and this bill will simplify some portions of the current process, but it's still going to be a difficult process. Most insurers, that's not true. Many insurers and some third-party administrators who are adjudicating the claims actually subcontract this portion of the claims management out.
The calculation.
The whole process, because it is complex. Some other insurers, Safe Corporation, for example, they do it in-house. They have the size of operation and the experts to handle this. But I don't want to, I would really not want to leave you with the impression that I was telling you that this is now going to make this process simple. No, it won't. This is an attempt to simplify the benefits structure, and I think it does do that. But the process of determination of permanent partial disability benefits is still going to be pretty complex.
And Mr. Schultz, that calculation that Representative Flores just mentioned, that actually doesn't take effect until 2008. Is that correct?
Yes. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes. That calculation in Section 2 that you were looking at is part of the sunset language that would only take effect if we go back to the present system. But similar calculations are in the bill as proposed.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the shift of it looks from your statement that there's actually going to be higher awards being paid out. And is this going to complicate? Let's put it this way: is there enough reserve or money in workers' comp to take care of this, or will the rates have to be adjusted to the businesses to increase their rates? I'd like to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, this proposal is designed to be roughly cost neutral, and what I mean by that is that the total amount of money that's spent to pay for permanent partial disability benefits in the Oregon system should remain roughly the same under this proposal. Some workers will see better benefit awards, but some workers are going to see smaller benefit awards as a result of these changes. Workers who are higher paid workers who do not return to their regular jobs are going to see better awards, especially if they fell into the old scheduled camp. Workers who are lower paid workers, on the other hand, again, who fell into the scheduled camp under this bill, if they return to regular work, will probably find themselves receiving smaller awards than what they would have under the old bill, or excuse me, under the old law.
So the rate, workers' comp, I know there's an amount taken out of our paychecks each time, and it's a set amount, and that rate is the same for everybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, yes, that's okay. Correct. That amount is the same for everyone. That's taken out for the Worker Benefit Fund, and that typically funds benefits to workers as well as some reimbursement programs for employers. That is not the actual assessment that would be affected by a change if benefit amounts went up in the workers' compensation system. That would actually affect the premium and the premium assessments that are paid by employers. We do not expect that this change is going to create any change in what we expect employers to pay for their premiums in Oregon. We think this is going to be cost neutral.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a series of them, I think, and they're not all on the same topic, if that's okay.
Yep. Thank you.
I'm looking at the structure of this bill, and it just dawned on me that the odd-numbered sections are the change, and the even-numbered sections are the ones that put it back where it used to be after the sunset. Okay, so I've got that part. That helps me a lot. I can read the odd-numbered sections and skip the even-numbered sections. All right. The other thing that I'm trying to understand, I thought I used to understand that I understood workers' comp, but I think it's very clear now that I don't. Are we talking about repeated regularized payments that are made to partially disabled people? Are we talking about lump sum payments that they receive once? What are we talking about?
Mr. Chair.
Or from a both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, these typically are lump sum payments that are made to workers at the end of the claim when the worker has been found to be medically stationary. And that means their physician doesn't expect them to typically get any better or get any worse. They're pretty much where they're going to be. And they're left with some permanent disability. And this is to compensate them for that permanent disability. They can get that in a lump sum payment if it's below a certain amount. If it's above a certain amount, they have to apply to get the lump sum payment. Typically, they get it when they apply for it in a lump sum. It also can be paid out in a monthly benefit amount if they so choose, or if certain other factors are present. For example, if the amount of the disability rating is in litigation, for example, then it's paid out in monthly benefits until the litigation is complete. Did I answer your question?
I think so. So in the case of a large, serious, significant injury, a very significant injury and a large lump amount, could that be annuitized in effect, or are we talking about a certain number of monthly payments that run out after a while? I mean, how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it can be paid in a lump sum to the worker, and then if the worker wanted to buy an annuity, he or she could typically do that. Or it could be paid out in monthly benefits. Some workers would prefer it that way, and the insurers would usually prefer it that way because they are able to collect a little bit of interest off it that way. So it typically can be done either way. And if there's a reason for it to be paid in a lump sum amount and the worker, if there's a reason for it to be paid out in a monthly benefit, the worker wants it in a lump sum amount, that's typically when the system would say no to the worker who wants it in a lump sum. But most of the time, if a worker wants a lump sum, they get it.
Okay. I think this is my last one, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
One of the conditions that you indicated in your testimony was that you wanted to encourage return to work. I think that is in Section 1, Subsection 2, A and B, but I'm not sure. Whether it's there or not, would you describe how that works in this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the current system works very similar to what we're proposing on the unscheduled injuries, that if a worker does not return to their regular job or not offered their regular job back, their physician says they can't go back to their regular job, then they get the impairment part of the benefit, what they've lost physically, and what we call the social vocational factors, age, adaptability, education are factored in. And there's actually a formula that will factor those things in to equal out more money to the worker. That's how this whole system is set up to work now. Every worker would qualify for that, regardless of what type of body part is injured. Currently, it's only the unscheduled awards that are eligible for the work disability factors. All these scheduled awards are not. So, for example, if I injure my left arm as a bureaucrat, if it's permanently disabled, that's really not going to disable me much. I'm going to go back to my regular job. One of my best friends is a really fine Finnish carpenter. He's left-handed. He does the same. He's not going to go back to his regular job probably forever. Under this bill, he will now be eligible for work disability factors to be added into the benefit. Under current law, he would not. On the other side, under current law, the scheduled degrees per disability, the actual small amounts per each little piece of disability that they count up, is paid at a little higher rate than the unscheduled is. That's supposed to make up for it, but it typically complicates the benefit structure. It's certainly not an equal benefit structure between those people. So this is an attempt to try to make everyone on the same level playing field. If you don't go back to your regular job, you're eligible for the work disability factors. By putting that in there, then, and my last statement would be, we're encouraging employers to offer permanent modified jobs for disabled workers, because they end up having to, in the end, pay for this. It's their money that eventually pays the premiums that the insurance companies pay out. So there's an incentive built in here for employers to bring more workers back to work, or at least that's the philosophy behind this. Okay? Thank you.
Anything further? Representative Berger.
Thank you very much for indulging me. I have one question. Does your department have like an ombudsman, or what process do injured workers go through if they have some grievance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes. The Department of Consumer and Business Services has an ombudsman for injured workers. And so they can go to the ombudsman's office, call the ombudsman's office, and contact them with a grievance or a problem. And I'm sorry to say I didn't bring that phone number with me, but Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I could provide Kara with the ombudsman's phone number for the committee members.
Yeah, that'd be fine for now. I mean,
that would be helpful.
Yeah, it's a really neat system. Works pretty well most of the time.
Further questions? All right. Thank you for testimony.
Thank you.
J.L. Wilson and Brad Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB, but in this bill representing the management side of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. Senate Bill 757 we consider to be one of the biggest work comp bills of the session, and we support the bill wholeheartedly. It represents about a year of work between management and labor over the last interim to come to some consensus on PPD issues as they relate to the simplicity of the system and the equity of the system and cost containment. And speaking from the management side, when you talk about simplicity, and John did a lot of the heavy lifting on this, you talk about getting rid of scheduled and unscheduled and the three tiers within the unscheduled, which Representative Flores alluded to when she went through her calculation. That's the old system we're steering away from in favor of a new system that factors in impairment and work disability. In terms of equity, the current system discriminates against people who are high wage earners, who have a work disability, and for the first time you're introducing wage sensitivity into work disability and the award that ensues, and we think that that's only fair. With regard to cost containment, the numbers that I based my support of this bill on, the current PPD system is an outlay of about $88.2 million a year. This system right here represents an outlay of about $87.6 million. So based on that cost neutrality is something that management is in support of for all the reasons that I just mentioned and everything that John went through. I just think it's a good bill. So I would ask for your support. Just for clarity's sake, the A6R amendments are at my request, and I would ask you to disregard them. I'm not interested in pursuing them, and I would prefer to see the bill move unamended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Witt, Oregon AFL-CIO, here this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 757 and asking for your support of it as well. I think that Representative Backlund's question of why is it this way hit the nail right squarely on the head on this bill, and the reason that we moved this bill forward, labor and management asked the question, why are we doing it this way? And there was no good answer.
And I don't think that that's just a curio from the state of Oregon. The vast majority of the states have scheduled and unscheduled disability awards for PPD, and I doubt that probably very many folks from any state could answer the question, you know, what good reason is there for doing it that way? So having asked the question, we set about over a year's period of time of saying, if we could, how would we do it differently? And this is the system that we came up with. It is a fresh approach, and it makes sense, and that is a very refreshing approach for workers' compensation. And I suspect that if our state moves forward with this bill, we're going to see a good number of other states taking a look at this and probably moving forward with a similar approach. As John Schultz has already told you, and my management counterpart here, Mr. Wilson, this is a bill that proposes that we have awards of disability for impairment, and any successful claimant that makes a PPD claim and is awarded that will receive that, and based on an equal percentage. That's not true today. As has already been indicated, the differences between a scheduled and unscheduled disability. And I would only give you as an example someone who is injured right here on the shoulder, right on the very edge. Is it a limb or is it the trunk of the body? Two entirely different awards. Some of those awards has already been indicated, relatively high. Others relatively low. If it is the trunk side of the body, further complicated and perhaps disadvantaged to the injured worker by three separate levels of tiers of benefits, usually paid at the lowest level. We are ridding the system of that, and also adding a factor where if and only if someone is unable to return to work, presumably seriously injured as a result, that those claimants are entitled to additional compensation because of their inability to return to work. And as you have heard, that also serves as an incentive to try and get workers back to work. And lastly, I think one of the most important components of this piece of legislation is protection for claimants against the potential ravages of inflation. For all of these good reasons, we support this bill and urge your support as well. Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. And seeing no one further to testify on Senate Bill 757, close the public hearing. Senate Bill 757, open up a work session. Senate Bill 757, Ms. LaForce.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm in voting for this bill. I'm accepting the team has done their work and they worked hard on it and got it right. I am not enough of an expert on workers' comp to have an opinion about whether this bill is a good bill or not based on my own analysis of it. Of course, that could be said about a lot of bills we deal with in this committee, I think, given that we deal with practically everything that isn't either revenue or budget here. I just wanted to say that I'm very pleased with the idea that people that there's a system being designed that will encourage getting people back to work. In my experience as a psychologist, before the 94 changes, I did a fair amount of work on cases involving people with significant mental health claims that arose out of other injuries, dealing with people who were very physically oriented, whose sense of worth was very wrapped up in their ability to work and in their working life, and who were at sea now that they were not able to work productively, or at least they couldn't find a job that they could work at productively. So things that we can do that are in a financial way that do not hurt the worker financially but have an incentive for an employer to get that worker back to work in some productive capacity that will obviate those kind of problems, I think, is a wonderful idea, and I'm very pleased to see it happening. I'm also wondering, although we didn't get into this, I'm hoping that this simplification is going to lead to reduced costs, both on the litigation side, and on reduced costs on the management of claims for the insurance companies and for management. All of those things, which increase fairness, reduce costs, and get people back to work, are good things, and I'm all in favor of them.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say that I think dealing with people who have been injured takes a special kind of treatment. There's a lot of trauma. They've been disassociated with their job, and I think it does take special treatment, and I think that people that are trying to work in that area have great challenges. But I would just like to encourage the department to do some more study during the interim about some of the people in rural areas that and how they are treated in trying to get medical opinions. And as our regional medical center increases on the coast and we get more and more specialists in, I think that that will be an easier job for the department.
Any further? All right, call the roll, please.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Montes Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Boyle.
Chair votes aye. And anybody want to take on workers' comp on the floor or go consent calendar?
Mr. Chair, I don't think this one ought to be on the consent calendar. This is too big a deal.
All right.
And if you need a carrier, I'd be happy to carry it, recognizing that I'm not an expert in this area, and it's going to be interesting if we get a lot of questions.
Yeah, and I have no problem carrying it either, so I'm happy to do that. The chair will carry. So, Senate Bill 757 then passes to the floor with due pass recommendation. And that concludes the work session on Senate Bill 757. And nothing further, we are adjourned.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.